Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Julian Marshall. In a moment, US trade tariffs and a furious reaction. Spain is about to lose a government. Italy has finally got one. And later, a day after he returned from the dead in the Ukrainian capital, Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko speaks to the BBC about his faked assassination.
My dear friend, let me put it like this. When the security service come to you and say there is an order out for your murder, are you going to stay proud and say, no, I won't take part because it's going to hurt the media's reputation? Come on.
That interview in full in about 30 minutes. So the United States has carried through on its threat to impose punitive tariffs on aluminium and steel imports from Canada, Mexico and the European Union. President Trump first announced his intention to do so back in March to fulfill a campaign promise to protect the US steel industry. US allies were granted a two-month exemption, but that expires in the early hours of Friday morning when the EU, Canada and Mexico will start having to pay a 25% penalty on steel they bring into the United States, 10% on aluminium. Canada has already imposed its own tariffs against the United States. Mexico has threatened retaliation. And the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, said the EU would also respond in kind.
This is a bad day for the world trade. The European Union cannot react to that without any kind of reaction. So we'll immediately introduce a settlement dispute on the WTO. It's totally unacceptable that a country is imposing unilateral measures when it comes to world trade.
But the US Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, speaking to the American CNBC network, said EU retaliatory measures would have little impact.
Even if the EU does retaliate, and even if some others do, it still will remain unlikely to be as much as 1% on our economy. Remember, just because they put tariffs on some of our products, it doesn't mean those sales will go to zero. And in the case of agriculture, they may very well find other markets that are just as good.
That was the US Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. Let's hear now from economist Linda Yu. She told me why the two-month exemption granted to the European Union, Canada and Mexico had now run out.
It was always a temporary exemption because, remember, the steel and aluminium tariffs were imposed on every country the United States trades with. And so in this period, the U.S. has been renegotiating NAFTA, which includes Canada and Mexico. And they've also been negotiating with the Europeans during this time to open up Europe's markets more. And that, I think, is why we now have the reimposition of the tariffs or the end of the temporary exemption, because the Americans don't feel the Europeans and the Mexicans and the Canadians have done enough to open their markets. And therefore, the U.S. is going to use this rather punitive set of tariffs to impose those to get these countries back to the bargaining table.
So it is possible that were the European Union, Canada and Mexico to make concessions, that these tariffs could be lifted at some point in the future?
Yes. And I think Wilbur Ross, who's the U.S. Commerce Secretary, said pretty much that. He said if the EU wants these tariffs lifted, they have to act like China. So China has been in negotiations with the United States. The U.S. is very concerned about the very large trade surplus that China runs with the U.S. So China's agreed to reduce that trade surplus. And so the Americans feel that they have gotten greater market opening, because obviously if you reduce the trade surplus, that implies that a more American goods are going to be sold to China. And that really works for especially American Rust Belt voters, people who are Trump supporters, to see this victory of sorts. But of course, the key difference is that China is a relatively closed market and the EU is not. So opening up further in terms of the European Union, it's not quite the same as dealing with China. But it is the case that Germany has a very large trade surplus, and it's always irked President Trump that there are more Mercedes in New York than Chevys or Fords in Berlin. And he always thought that was because the European markets were closed to the United States. There are probably other reasons for that.
President Trump originally said that he wanted to impose these tariffs to protect the U.S. steel industry. Will they?
They will for some time if you impose tariffs as high as 25% on imported steel. That is going to reduce steel imports. So I guess in that sense, the Americans have been over worried. They've been worried, as others have, about overcapacity, steel getting dumped into their market. So that probably will restrict imports. But that's not the same thing as saying that will revive the U.S. steel industry. Even though we think of steel as a simple commodity, it's actually produced in supply chain. So rolled steel is different than, for instance, more raw materials that go into making steel. The U.S. doesn't have capacity. It'd be very expensive for them to produce all the kinds of steel that they're currently importing, and it doesn't quite make economic sense. So in the long term, protectionism doesn't really work when you have supply chains, because supply chains are actually more efficient than a country doing it all on its own.
As of now, the United States is being very dismissive of any possible retaliation from the European Union. With justification?
I think the European Union doesn't want to launch a trade war, but they are going to impose retaliatory tariffs, which would be allowed under the World Trade Organization, because the U.S. imposing tariffs on these metals isn't really regarded as within the WTO rules. So the U.S. has appealed to what's called the national security exemption. But this, when it's adjudicated before the WTO, will unlikely stand up. So the Europeans have said they will immediately start action in the WTO to rule against what the U.S. have done. And under the WTO rules, the Europeans can retaliate on any range of products. So they could target products in key congressional districts so that congressmen could put pressure on President Trump not to go down this road and launch a trade war. But if they retaliate and then the Americans go further, that's highly damaging and a massive escalation. The Europeans are not going to want to go there. So I suppose in that sense, if you know nobody wants to launch a trade war, then you don't expect these retaliatory measures to be that strong. But that's a pretty precarious game to be playing, I think, in international trade.
Linda, you're economist and author of The Great Economist, How Their Ideas Can Help Us Today. And let's go now to Canada, where, as I mentioned, the government has been quick to retaliate against the imposition of tariffs by the United States. Within the past few hours, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, said the country was imposing its own tariffs.
The American administration has made a decision today that we deplore and obviously is going to lead to retaliatory measures, as it must. But we would much rather move together in partnership, understanding that no two countries have economies as interwoven and mutually beneficial as Canada and the United States.
And Chrystia Freeland, the Canadian Foreign Minister, gave some details about what those retaliatory measures would involve.
In response to these measures, Canada intends to impose tariffs against imports of steel, aluminum, and other products from the United States, representing the total value of 2017 Canadian exports affected by the U.S. measures. That is $16.6 billion. We are imposing dollar-for-dollar tariffs for every dollar levied against Canadians by the U.S.
So what's at stake here? Just how much steel does Canada export to the United States? Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail.
You know, it's our largest market for exported Canadian steel. It's basically the entire Canadian steel industry and aluminium industries are effectively, you know, dependent on having access to the American market. So it's the sort of thing that you can't really lose access to without potentially costing quite a few jobs in Canada and really hurting those industries.
So Canada's going to take a big hit because of this?
The foreign minister announced today, in terms of the $16.6 billion tariffs on $16.6 billion worth of U.S. goods coming into the country, is basically meant to mirror exactly how much business they expect to have tariffs imposed on what's going to the U.S. So that's sort of the number that they're looking at. It's about $16.6 billion worth of Canadian goods going to the states that are going to be affected by the tariffs. Which could have a significant effect, and particularly in sort of a handful of communities that really sort of depend on those places as major employers, in southern Ontario and Quebec.
So what American products has Canada singled out for tariffs?
So there's a series of American products that are made with steel and aluminum, including beer kegs and a few things like that. And then on top of that, they've hit a bunch of other primarily sort of agricultural goods. So everything from pizza to maple syrup to a few random things like ballpoint pens, inflatable boats, toilet paper. It's sort of a long laundry list of a bunch of different tariff items. And basically, the Canadian government's intent is to send a message and sort of cause economic pain to the U.S. On the same proportion as they're going to cause to Canada, but without sort of hitting anything that they think is necessarily vital to Canadian industry. So for instance, they could have imposed a 25% tariff on all U.S.-made steel and aluminum that's imported into Canada, but they chose not to do that. Instead, they chose to sort of pick and choose a handful of products that they felt weren't sort of necessary to make the Canadian economy move, but could still sort of cause economic pain to the U.S.
But there's clearly anger in Canada at this move by the United States.
Yeah, Trudeau to date has really treated Donald Trump with kid gloves. Or I think he's sort of had the notion that we can stand up for Canadian interests behind the scenes, but by and large, we have to sort of charm the guy, I guess, if we want to get along with him and sort of not have him mistreat us. So today I think there was a marked shift in tone from the Prime Minister. Not only in the fact that they basically said we're going to retaliate within the next month, and it's going to be dollar for dollar, so everything you do to us, we're going to visit on you as well, but the fact that he was actually willing to sort of criticize the U.S. president and say that he's not, acting in common sense, and that he's sort of hurting his own economy by bringing these sorts of tariffs in. So, that's about as angry as you're going to see Justin Trudeau in his dealings with the U.S. president. And I think this does sort of mark a bit of a turning point, I think, for the way the Canadians are standing up to Donald Trump.
That was Adrian Morrow, the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. And do stay with us here on NewsHour. We'll be returning to this topic in about 15 minutes. And don't forget that if you want to listen to NewsHour but miss the live broadcast, a podcast of the programme is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine BBC NewsHour podcast and you'll find it there. You can also subscribe to the feed if you want to receive it on a regular basis. Coming up, Arkady Babchenko and how he staged his own murder.
They put makeup on me. The blood used was real. Everything was done for real. My wife called the police. They took me to the morgue, and until I was through the gates, I had to pretend to be dead.
And our headlines this hour: in the past half hour, Italy's president has asked Giuseppe Conte to be the country's next prime minister. It's the second time he's done so in 8 days. Also, the European Union, Canada and Mexico say they'll retaliate against the United States, which is to impose tariffs on steel and aluminium imports within hours. And the US Secretary of State said it would be a tragedy if the United States and North Korea wasted what he called a pivotal moment in their relationship. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. And as we've just been hearing, Italy's president has asked Giuseppe Conte to be the country's next prime minister, the second time he's done so in 8 days. He was the original choice of the anti-establishment Five-Star Movement and far-right League Party, but their nomination for Finance Party was rejected by the president because he was deemed to be Eurosceptic. But Mr. Conte's new selection of ministers has clearly been approved by the president. Jenny Hill joins us live from Rome. And Jenny, do we know the lineup of this new government?
Yeah, we're starting to get a pretty good idea of it. So Let's start straight off, actually, with that. The man that both parties had originally wanted to be finance minister, Paolo Savona, a man who in the past has openly criticised the euro, doesn't much like Italy being a member of the currency, according to what he said in the past. He's still going to be in the cabinet. Now, this is interesting because, of course, the negotiations on this coalition fell apart when the Italian president vetoed his candidacy as finance minister. But the parties have still got their way. He's still in the cabinet. It looks as though he's going to be Minister for European Affairs, which will be very interesting. Soothing the feathers, though, of not only the Italian president is the economics, the economy ministry, now going to a man called Giovanni Tria. He's an economics professor, and one would assume would take a slightly more centrist line, perhaps, on the euro, because we know it's been accepted by the Italian president. That will, of course, calm, perhaps, fears at the highest level of the EU, who've been watching what's been going on here in Italy with horror and dismay. Worth pointing out that the leaders of both the League and Five Star will both not only be deputy prime ministers jointly, but the League's Matteo Salvini will be the country's interior minister, while Luigi Di Maio from Five Star will be heading up a new ministry which combines labour and industry. So we're just getting all of these names coming out now. It's the news, of course, that Europe's been waiting for. It'll end, certainly, weeks of speculation, which have spooked the financial markets. Would suggest, though, that perhaps the drama isn't over just yet. There's a long way to go. These parties, as you know, sit at opposite ends of the political spectrum. And some of what they've been proposing, including tax and welfare reforms, as well as plans on immigration to, for example, deport 500,000 migrants from Italy, are doing more than just raise eyebrows here in Italy. They're causing controversy within the country, but, of course, further afield. And let's not forget, too, that this whole debacle, if you like, this whole drama has raised that question of whether Italy is really committed not only to the euro currency, but to the EU and its values.
And Jenny, the programme of this new coalition government, of course, has to be approved by Parliament. Do the two parties between them have the necessary majority?
I think they do. You know, I need to look at the numbers in closer detail. But what's very interesting here is that Matteo Salvini's, the League party, looks to have the support of a far-right party here. In fact, there was chatter at some point as to whether some of that far-right party might be invited to join the cabinet, might actually take over a ministry. Now, they've not done so, but my understanding is that there may be an agreement in place, perhaps a kind of support agreement, so this far-right party, if necessary, certainly wouldn't be calling for any no-confidence vote, for example. So it's entirely likely that that party's support will help carry through any of these rather controversial policies.
Now, Jenny, you're a long way from home. We normally hear from you from Berlin, and I was just wondering what the reaction is likely to be of the German government to this new, well, very broadly Eurosceptic government in Italy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's worth pointing out that there will be some relief that the uncertainty is over. But what's happened in Italy and the formation of this government, I think, won't come as much of a surprise to the government in Berlin or, of course, beyond that in Europe. You know, we're seeing again and again this level of Euroscepticism raising its head, this populism sweeping across Europe. Chancellor Merkel in Germany talks frequently of, you know, trying to allay the fears of individual voters who are turning to populist parties like this, who often, of course, campaign on issues like immigration, unemployment, the economy, which is exactly what has swept these two parties to power here in Italy. I think Angela Merkel addresses this from time to time in her speeches, but accepts, probably with a degree of concern, that the EU really needs to address this and address it fast.
Jenny, many thanks for that. That was the BBC's Jenny Hill speaking from Rome. And from in to out Elsewhere in Europe, Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy may only have hours left in office. His People's Party is currently mired in a corruption scandal, and the opposition Socialist Party is planning a no-confidence vote in Mr. Rajoy on Friday. The Socialists need an absolute majority in Parliament, and they now seem to have got it with the support of a small Basque Nationalist Party. As for Mr. Rajoy, he says at the moment he has no intention of resigning ahead of a no-confidence vote. I've been speaking to the BBC's Gavin Lee in Madrid, and I asked him if Mr. Rajoy was simply postponing his execution.
Some might say that, and tell you what, there's an incredible line of people in Madrid here with me, amidst the wall of cameras and journalists waiting to see if there is news from Rajoy, and indeed the debate that's still going on. I'm under the statue of the great Spanish storyteller right now, Cervantes, because opposite is where there's an incredible story being told from inside Congress, because the debate's continuing. Tomorrow there is the vote of no confidence motion against Mariano Rajoy, and here's the stats. 176 MPs need to vote against him for him to be ousted. Right at about midday today, there were 173, so they needed just a few more, and this is why most of the papers picked up on the fact, and you mentioned it, the Basque Nationalist Party, the PNV, all of a sudden were the possible kingmaker. So this afternoon they had an announcement to make that their five MPs will support the motion of against Mariano Rajoy. That means the figures work out just about enough major parties and minor parties, the Catalans and the Basque Nationalists, to remove him in 24 hours' time. Mariano Rajoy, you mentioned that he defended himself in the Congress today. He talked to the other parties, the Socialists, who are bringing forward this motion. He said, "Your parties do not act like any Mother Teresa's yourself. We have had problems, but they were 15 years ago," he said. "We have cleaned up our act." No sign of him disappearing tonight. All sorts of rumours about it. But bear in mind, if this no-confidence motion does go ahead, it would be surprising to still see him in a job this time tomorrow night.
And does it mean that the Socialists will automatically assume power, Gavin?
As things stand, yes. Pedro Sanchez would be set to become the next Prime Minister of Spain, this relatively quiet Socialist leader who's not actually an MP. Also, you know, it's not often you see a potential Prime Minister being basically the representative and leader of the party, but not a standing MP. The other view is the major party, probably the only party doing well in the polls right now, the Citizens Party, who benefited from their sort of stance on the Catalan crisis, being quite strong to pro-EU, model themselves on a centrist sort of Macron-type politics. They say that they are not taking part. They don't want the Socialists to be in control. They want to snap election, and they're trying to muster another no-confidence vote. Meanwhile, Mariano Rajoy calls the whole thing, if the numbers are mustered tomorrow, the Frankenstein movement. He says it will unleash a political monster of all sorts of parties who come together to oust him. Thing is, he survived a no-confidence vote last year, only the third ever in Spain. They've all failed before. All of the reports suggest here it will go ahead as planned tomorrow.
The BBC's Gavin Lee speaking from Madrid. Do stay with us here on NewsHour. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. Coming up next, Russian dissident journalist Arkady Babchenko, in his own words, living as a dead man in a hoax that foiled the world. And more on reaction to the US trade tariffs. But first, the world's largest known freshwater pearl, which once belonged to Catherine the Great, has just been sold in the Netherlands for $374,000. The pearl is renowned for its irregular shape and approximately 300-year history, during which time it changed hands between colonial merchants, noble jewellers and European royals. Anna Holligan reports.
A rare, glistening gem created entirely by Mother Nature. The pearl weighs 120 grams, a little more than your average bar of soap, and is almost 7 centimetres long. But those statistics only tell a fraction of this story. Dr. Hanko Zwan is from the Netherlands Gemological Laboratory.
Why is it so special? First of all, it's extremely large to begin with. Second, it's a natural pearl. So it's not cultured. So most pearls we see today are all cultured. The third thing is that it's not from salt water, but from fresh water, actually.
The extraordinary jewel is thought to have been formed in Chinese waters in the first half of the 18th century during the Qing Dynasty. Sometime around 1765, the pearl was moved to Jakarta, at the time Batavia, by a Dutch merchant from the Dutch East India Company. And here's where the detail gets murky. It was then shipped across to Europe, probably violating the Chinese Emperor Qinglong's ban on the export of large pearls. When the Dutch merchant passed away, the pearl was auctioned off in Amsterdam in 1778 and acquired by Catherine the Great, Empress of Russia. Catherine displayed the pearl at the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg until 1796. In the tumultuous years that followed her death, the pearl vanished and turned up in Poland. In 1865, it came into the possession of a Dutch goldsmith and was passed down as a family heirloom for four generations. In 1779, it was purchased by the Amsterdam Pearl Society and Herman A. Domese, who's been explaining why he's selling it today.
You can't say, because I need a new car or something like that, but that's not the reason.
A private collector with a very important natural history piece, it had to be displayed in an institution. I think the public had to see it.
The Sleeping Lion's epic journey continues.
Anna Holligan with that report from the Netherlands. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. We return to our main story this hour, the imposition by the United States of tariffs on steel and aluminium imports from Mexico, Canada and the European Union. There's been some pretty immediate reaction. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, said Canada is imposing its own tariffs against the United States. The French President, Emmanuel Macron, said the US decision was a mistake and illegal. A spokesman for the German government echoed Mr. Macron, adding that Washington's claim that it was acting in the interests of national security did not stand up. Kayleigh McEnany, the spokesperson for the Republican National Committee in the United States, however, explained why these measures were being imposed.
We want to protect our domestic industry, particularly steel and aluminum, and we are going to do that via sanctions. This is a campaign promise, as you mentioned. It's a very bold move. It comes with a lot of methodical thought behind it. This was a year-plus process, a study conducted by the Commerce Department, talks with our allies. So this was a measured approach, a thoughtful one, and the time is now.
And Wilbur Ross, the U.S. Commerce Secretary, said he was confident that the imposition of these tariffs wouldn't damage America's relationship with the EU.
These are blips in the radar screen. I don't think they change the fundamentals of relationship. Everybody has spats every now and again. Every family does, every country does with others. There's nothing weird about that. I think everybody will get over this in due course.
Well, I'm joined now by Marit Schaake, a Dutch member of the European Parliament who sits on the International Trade Committee. Well, you heard it there from Mr. Ross. This is simply a blip on the radar.
Well, I think he's really misread all the signs that have been very clearly coming from Europe to the Trump administration. We have extended our hands. There have been very high-level discussions between Prime Minister May, President Macron, Chancellor Merkel, of course, Commissioner Malmström, responsible for international trade. It has been conveyed to the Americans loudly and clearly that treating us as a national security threat, because that's the argument that they're using to justify these tariffs on steel and aluminum, is misguided. And we will indeed see a challenge before the WTO and balancing measures. So this is really the scenario that the EU and we're very united in this, wanted to avoid. So I think that the Americans have their own reading of the facts, and I'm afraid it will hurt American people too.
As I understand it, Canada, Mexico and the European Union got a 2-month exemption while you had trade talks and tried to sort something out on that front. What went wrong there?
There were not actually trade talks. I mean, before President Trump was elected to the White House, there were years of negotiations between the European Union and the United States on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP. There was a lot of discussion about it, also in the public, and it was by far not finished. But that's when we were negotiating with the US. Those negotiations stopped. People now talk about TTIP being in the freezer, in a very, very deep freezer. And so these were not negotiations. What was going on was a discussion about the legitimacy or the lack of legitimacy of the proposed measures to impose tariffs by the American administration. We've always said, and I firmly agree with that, that we should not negotiate with a metaphorical gun pointed at our heads. We cannot negotiate under pressure this way. This is not the way mature partnership negotiations go. We see the United States as an ally, as a country that shares values and interests, including rules-based trade and liberal democracy. And this is simply not a way to treat allies. And so I think this is very misguided. It is a slap in the face. And it is really a rejection of the extended hand that we've offered to the United States.
In addition, the U.S. Commerce Secretary says any retaliatory measures that the European Union takes will barely impact on the U.S. economy. He's right, isn't he?
Why?
Well, insofar as he says that any retaliatory measures would only affect, what, 1%? Of the US economy? It's probably quite a lot, but...
Yeah, it would be quite a lot. And I think that in these days where people are still scrambling for jobs and economic growth is picking up in Europe, but we can always use more. I think to dismiss a negative impact on the economy is misguided. And also, usually with trade measures such as the tariffs imposed by the US and the rebalancing measures that we may expect from the EU, the impact can ripple quite far, can be unexpected, and it can take a long time to know exactly where the impact is. And sometimes it sets off a chain reaction. And when we look in the past at trade wars, about which the US president claims they're easy to win and they're not problematic, I think if you look in history, we can see that they are very problematic and that measures often take a long time to reverse. So again, this moment of imposed tariffs by the US and the necessary response to rebalance from the European side is something we would have liked to avoid. And we also don't think of lightly.
And very, very briefly, this might be described as a trade dispute at the moment. What's the danger of it escalating into a trade war, very briefly?
Well, it also depends on what the US is going to do with China. We live in mutually dependent economies, global trade flows. And so I hope the damage will be minimized. But it's also up to the US to wake up to what it's doing. And I hope that Republicans in Congress, as well as the private sector, will finally speak out.
Ms. Schaake, many thanks. That was Marit Schaake, a Dutch member of the European Parliament who sits on the International Trade Committee. The dissident Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko this week gave a new meaning to the word death. It need only be temporary, especially if the whole point of it is to keep you alive. Mr. Babchenko was widely reported to have been shot dead in Kiev on Tuesday, only to reappear at a news conference in the city the following day to explain that he'd willingly cooperated with the Ukrainian security services in his staged death to thwart a genuine Russian plot to assassinate him. Mr. Babchenko has been widely criticised for his action, for putting his family and colleagues through such unnecessary grief, for undermining journalism and for handing Moscow a propaganda gift. But Mr. Babchenko is unrepentant. He has again been defending himself today, as well as giving more details of the hoax. So, was he in a bullish mood? The BBC's Jonah Fisher in Kiev.
Well, reasonably bullish. There were lots of unanswered questions arising from the press conference yesterday when Arkady Babchenko came back from the dead, so to speak. So in search of answers, I met up with Mr. Babchenko in the big offices of the SBU. That's Ukraine's security services. It was them who worked with him on this entire fake plot. And I started off by asking Mr. Babchenko to talk me through exactly what had happened on the night of the fake assassination on Tuesday.
They put makeup on me. The blood used was real. Everything was done for real. My wife called the police, so the special police came, and emergency services too. They took me to the morgue, and until I was through the gates, I had to pretend to be dead.
Did you have some misgivings about taking part in a huge fake like this?
My dear friend, let me put it like this. When the security service come to you and say there is an order out for your murder, are you going to stay proud and say, no, I won't take part because it's going to hurt the media's reputation? Come on.
But as a journalist, can you see how this episode can erode trust in basic information and the work of journalists?
Okay, what choice did I have? What would you choose in my place?
Jenna, there was some uncertainty yesterday over whether Mr. Babchenko's wife was aware of this operation. Were you able to clarify that with him?
Yeah, I was. This was raised at the press conference yesterday and got people talking because Mr. Babchenko mentioned his wife specifically at that press conference and said she deserved a special apology. And people rather jumped to the conclusion that that meant that she hadn't been told that this was all a fake plot and that she had actually, for a period of time, thought that her husband was dead. I asked him about it today. He didn't want to go into many details about it, but enough to say that she was involved. He talked about how she had helped him prepare the clothes and the blood before the police were called. So she was fully aware. I think it was pretty clear from his demeanour and the way he didn't want to talk about it that it was still a very raw and a very sensitive subject, though.
There's been a lot of criticism internationally for Mr. Babchenko. I mean, where does Ukrainian public opinion stand on all this?
I think we have to separate these things out. Mr. Babchenko on one side and the Ukrainian security services on the other. I think there's a considerable amount of sympathy for Mr. Babchenko, as in he was put in a pretty impossible position. The security services came to him and they said, there is a plot to kill you. Money is being paid to kill you. They've got your passport details. They know where you live. They've got your wife's passport details. We've got this plan, which means that we can try and catch the people who are trying to kill you. I think most people accept that in those circumstances, you'd be pretty tempted to go along with the security services at that point. The bigger debate here is about the Ukrainian security services. What was the point in going through with this all the way to the murder actually being announced? And then we had probably about 19 hours while we all assumed that Mr. Babchenko was dead. What was the purpose in all of that? Did it really achieve anything apart from massively damaging the credibility of the security services here and the authorities in general? That is the discussion which is being had. The Ukrainians are saying they got lots of good intelligence, not just this single arrest which they've made. I think many people are waiting to see whether there are actually more specific details. There's talk of lists of other targets that was handed over. I think people will want to see some evidence that all this trouble was really worth it in the end.
And Mr. Babchenko's plans now, Jonah, does he intend to go on living in Kiev?
Yeah, that's what appears to be the case. He's being treated as something of a hero at this point. He met with Ukraine's president yesterday, who gave him a pretty warm embrace. And there's talk of him getting Ukrainian citizenship. He is a Russian now. I did talk to him about security. Obviously, Mr. Babchenko has been spared the assassin's bullet this week. But if there is some sort of list in Moscow or who knows where of people that are being targeted, one would imagine that this entire experience hasn't withdrawn Mr. Babchenko from any consideration. He's probably right up near the top of any possible assassins list at the moment. So he did say that he will be taking heightened security precautions. And I think the Ukrainian security services will be helping him to try and keep him safe now.
That was the BBC's Jonah Fisher in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. And within the last couple of hours, a court in Kiev has granted a request by the authorities to detain a suspect in relation to that alleged plot to kill Mr. Babchenko. The suspect, Boris Herman, the owner of a weapons company, denies any intent to kill the journalist. A reminder of our top story this hour. The European Union, Canada and Mexico say they'll retaliate against the United States, which is to impose tariffs on steel and aluminium imports within hours. Adrian Morrow of Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper told NewsHour the Canadian response would be swift but targeted.
The Canadian government's intent is, to send a message and sort of cause economic pain to the U.S. On the same proportion as they're going to cause to Canada, but without sort of hitting anything that they think is necessarily vital to Canadian industries.
One of the headlines this hour, Italy's president has asked Giuseppe Conte to be the country's next prime minister. It's the second time he's done so in 8 days. He was the original choice of the populist parties, and he'll now resume the task of putting together a government. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. For the second year running, Save the Children has produced a league table ranking countries according to where it's best to be a child and where it's most difficult. This year, though, the charity has faced problems of its own, with allegations of sexual abuse and inappropriate behaviour by its own staff here in London. I've been speaking to Helle Thorning-Schmidt, CEO of Save the Children International, about their latest survey and the threat to children from conflict, child labour, child marriage and exclusion from education. Is poverty, I asked her, the underlying cause?
The interesting thing about doing this list is that we are seeing actually rather poor countries doing better than you would have expected. And that shows that it's not only poverty that defines whether a child can have a full childhood in that country. What's more important is actually that you have conscious government policies to help a child living a full childhood. And for example, even though you're a very poor country, you could still introduce legislation to end child marriages. You could also see countries that are moving up and becoming more wealthy, like the country that I'm in right now, the Philippines. The Philippines is the only country in Asia that hasn't moved up in the index. And one of the reasons for that is that they haven't worked in a precise and conscious way with their nutrition policies.
I know that you feel the need to produce a global report, but one of the consequences of that is that you end up with a lot of statistics. 1.2 billion, for instance, 175 countries, which in a way sort of depersonalizes all the things that you want to talk about, poor health, malnutrition.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why we're trying to put a face on these things. And we're trying in all the work that we do to speak for the children that we meet every day. Just yesterday, I met a girl who was 15. She had her child when she was only 14. And that child, with the help of an organization like Save the Children, with the help that we were giving her, she learned about nutrition for this child. She learned to breastfeed. And we also talked to her about family planning.
You're obviously in the business Save the Children of holding governments to account. But I would like to talk briefly about the charity itself. And you're doubtless aware that last month here in the UK, the Charity Commission decided that it was going to formally investigate Save the Children over allegations that it failed to investigate sexual abuse and inappropriate behaviour by staff. Your reaction to that development?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say in general that I've been appalled and I'm extremely sorry when I've heard about what two individuals and say the Children UK has admitted in terms of sexual harassment, and this should never have taken place. We have apologised. Our chairman last week went in front of the Select Committee in Parliament, and he also apologised for having failed those women. So what we are determined to do is to make sure that we have a zero tolerance in terms of sexual harassment. And what we are rolling out now, actually as we speak, is a training program for all the 17,000 members of staff that I'm responsible for, which means that everyone will be able to recognize sexual harassment. They will simply know what it is. They will be able to address it. This will be part of everyone's induction. And as we speak, we are training the trainers who will be training the rest of our staff members, because we will not have sexual harassment in our organisation.
Ms. Thorning-Schmidt, you're speaking to me about it now. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you have been somewhat silent up until now, and you are a proclaimed feminist. One would have expected you to have spoken about this a long time before.
I don't think I have been silent. I issued statements, but it was only natural. I mean, this, of course, occurred before I even joined Save the Children. And it was also incidents that happened in Save the Children UK. So we felt it was natural. It was the CEO of the organisation in UK that spoke up about these issues. But I don't think I've been silent. And I will say to you, yes, I am a feminist, and I don't want this to happen in our organisation.
Helle Thorning-Schmidt, CEO of Save the Children International, speaking to us from Manila. America's top diplomat and a senior North Korean official have wrapped up 2 days of talks in New York in preparation for a possible summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. A U.S. State Department official said there was progress in the talks between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Kim Jong-chol, regarded as a right-hand man to the North Korean leader. After the talks, Mr. Pompeo was in an upbeat mood.
We think that, working together, the people of the United States and North Korea can create a future defined by friendship and collaboration, not by mistrust and fear and threats.
So is the United States still insisting on immediate and verifiable denuclearization? Our correspondent Barbara Platasha is in New York.
Yes, they haven't wavered from their public position that this is what they want. But Mr. Pompeo was quite upbeat about the talks of the past 72 hours. He said there had been real progress towards setting the conditions for a summit. And he defined that vaguely as the conditions that would allow Kim Jong-un and President Trump to actually achieve something if they sat down face to face. So, of course, we all want to know how that would happen, given that it's so difficult to square the circle with this maximalist demand from the Americans on one hand and the North Korean reluctance on the other. But Mr. Pompeo said that both sides had very clearly stated their positions and their expectations. On the American side, this idea that all the nuclear weapons should be dismantled. On the North Korean side, in particular, that they were seeking security guarantees should they give up their weapons. Now, there's still lots more to talk about, and he said that, but he sounded like they were very much on the pathway towards a summit. And Kim Jong-chol is on his way to Washington to hand deliver a letter from the North Korean leader to President Trump.
And we have absolutely no idea, obviously, what is in that letter. But is it possible to say whether the Singapore summit now looks more or less likely as a result of these talks in New York?
Well, I think I would say it looks more likely because Mr. Pompeo, in essence, although he didn't announce the summit was on, I think he went as close as he could have done after this kind of diplomacy. We'll see what happens tomorrow when Kim Jong-chol hand delivers that letter. It was interesting also the statements that Mr. Pompeo made in terms of the big picture. He said that the North Korean regime was contemplating a strategic shift in terms of disarming its nuclear weapons and integrating into the international community. He said that Kim Jong-un had not made that decision yet, but if he did, he was the one to carry it out. He was a bold leader. And he also said the United States was ready to redefine the relationship. He said we could redefine it in terms of friendship and collaboration rather than mistrust and hostility. So he, at least, is looking at the longer term.
Our correspondent, Barbara Platasha, speaking from New York. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.